The Moody Blues were very different from the other British supergroups of the 1960s. The Beatles and the Stones, in the beginning anyway, were singles bands, and more importantly, they were celebrities. But the Moody Blues didn't have a single personality that fans or music writers could latch onto. Even as their albums were selling millions of copies, it's unlikely that any of the Moody Blues musicians would have been mobbed on the street or chased through hotel lobbies by screaming girls. That wasn't what the Moody Blues were all about. There was something about the Moodies that somehow made them seem more serious than other bands of the time. Perhaps it was the classical aspirations of their music, the complex orchestrations, or the cosmic tone of many of their lyrics early on. They were by choice an anonymous sort of band, looking more like college students than rock stars. The Moody Blues thought of themselves as musicians, not celebrities. Now, in spite of all that, the Moodies became one of the most popular rock bands Britain has ever produced. Year after year, they were right up there with the Beatles and the Stones, frequently outselling them both. Featuring dense, lush arrangements of rock songs with up to 30 different musical instruments, from a band sporting all five members as songwriters and four of them trading lead vocals. The breakthrough success of 1967's Days of Future Past left the Moody Blues as the proverbial square peg in the round hole of the record business. Moody Blues bass player, singer, songwriter John Lodge explains to me in the studio.
The Days of Future Past, the Moody Blues still didn't sit into what was the norm, you know, either bubblegum or the pop or the hip pop at the time. We were still into this progressive, psychedelic, underground, whatever name.
Nobody
they
knew
could,
where we were.
Whatever name people could put to us. So the people in the record company couldn't really associate with us at all. And this is when Sir Edward Lewis realized that we'd sort of superseded what people were trying to put you in a little pocket about. And he suddenly realized that we didn't really belong anywhere amongst any of his acts. We were a different type of band. He's rung me at 6 o'clock on a Monday morning and said, John, I know it's early. I said, you're not kidding, it's early. But this very English gentleman,
hello, John, Edward Lewis here. I'd like to say that played the record to some of my colleagues and friends yesterday at dinner. Thoroughly loved it. Wonderful. Well done, chap. Well done.
Yeah. And that would be it. I think it's emotion. I mean, an audience has to be moved by emotion. And whatever it is, whether it's heavy rock or rap or whatever, if you can move them, you've made your impact. And I think that's what the Moody Blues have tried to do.
Inside that we need so much. The sight of a touch or the scent of a sound or the strength of an oak with roots deep in the ground. The wonder of flowers to be covered and then to burst up through tarmac to the sun again. Or to fly to the sun without burning a wing. To lie in a meadow and hear the grass sing. To have all these things in our memories haunt and to use them to help.
Just for me. Ride, take
Ride My Seesaw was a solid hit from the Moody Blues on their July 1968 album In Search of the Lost Chord, proving that the UK and European success of the hits Nights in White Satin and Tuesday Afternoon was no fluke. The Cinderella story of Days of Future Past allowed the Moody Blues to do a follow-up album in 1968. Justin Hayward joined me to remind us of the significance of In Search of the Lost Chord.
You know, Lost Chord was a very exciting album for us because we were doing it. We didn't have the help of any, you know, there was no orchestra or any particular, you know, strong concept or anything like that. So Lost Chord, we were all on our own doing this stuff. There was no one else to help us there. That was a big sort of test for us.
Justin Hayward of the Moody Blues explains why the Blues were quick to embrace the psychedelia and mysticism paralleled by the Beatles in the UK and the San Francisco bands like Jefferson Airplane and the Grateful Dead in the US.
I think we were always seeking for some kind of enlightenment, you know, as a whole generation was, but I think we were probably doing it harder than a lot of other people, and it came from a lot of the things that we were reading and people that we were meeting. I think the nature of the music that we were making opened a lot of doors for us with people in general, and we met a lot of very interesting people who were interested in our music and the things that we were doing. And it was rather different to a normal kind of rock group, really, the kind of areas that we were moving into. And there was, for me, there was the whole psychedelia thing of LSD and the literature around that and the ritual around it, then transcendental meditation along with a lot of other a hodgepodge of stuff that, you know, that you make up really when you're young and forms part of your beliefs really. And but it was like being a kind of sponge to all of these ideas and then reflecting them back. And each one of those songs for me is I think that we were doing at those time at the time is straight from the heart, and it's a pure reflection of a kind of innocence, if you like, you know, that was tapped straight into and given a clear inspirational performance in the studio and on record.
The curtain rises on a scene with someone shouting to be free. The play unfolds before my eyes.
this ends the actor who is me. Hours take us far from traffic, telephones, and fear. Put out your problems with the cat. Escape until the bell you hear. Our reasons are the same, but there's no one we can blame. For there's nowhere we need go. And the
Justin Hayward of the Moody Blues here.
And I'm John Lodge, in the studio for the Moody Blues box set.
Part 1, with Redbeard.
Thank you, gentlemen. As so often is the case, John Lodge and Moody Blues drummer Graham Edge said that they were certainly no shortage of people suddenly claiming credit.
The amazing thing is, what happened after Days of Future Past, the amount of people in the record company who had ignored us, refused everything at all to do with us, the amount of people that turned up and decided it was them who had instigated the album was unbelievable. And when you think, you know, little did they realize we were living in Holland, in Belgium and Paris at the time. That's where we were writing the album. And we were up, you know, I mean, really were beg, steal and borrow, selling equipment to keep alive, literally, so we could write this our own stage show. And the people that turn up afterwards and said, well, we were part of that. You're saying, what part? You know, tell me what part. Where were you when we was dividing $10 up on the bed to try and find out who could eat? You know, and you know, the car's running out of gas, so you have to walk or take a bus.
And, of course, we'd got our third album on release when in America, which is the big market, when Days of Future Past really burst here. It had sold enough so that people would record companies would remain interested. But we'd actually done In Search of the Lost Chord, and we were just releasing Threshold when Nights got to number one here, and the album shot right up. So there was this sort of, we were very big in Europe, but it had sort of grew quite slowly in America. So we had plenty of, it didn't come with that crack of thunder, that 10 years working for the overnight success, you know. We kind of bled into it.
I think also as well, we when we came over on our first tour of America, I mean, obviously we'd been working in England as the Moody's and sort of pre-Moody's for 10 and 12 years before then. So we came across to America in 68 for the first major tour. And we were over here for about 3 or 4 months. And we were just picking up shows. We had two major gigs. We had the Fillmore East at sort of at the beginning of the tour, and the Fillmore West at the end of the tour, and we had to try and fill in. I mean, literally, that's what the tour
was.
U-Haul trucks and whatever.
Playing in clubs. Didn't quite play behind Chicken Wire, but they should have been.
You'll hear them boast about a light they say that shines so clear. So raise your glass, we'll drink a toast to the little man who sells you thrills along the pier. He'll take you up, he'll bring you down, he'll plant your feet back firmly on the ground. He flies so high, he swoops so low, he knows exactly which way he's gonna go.
Thank you.
From In Search of the Lost Chord, the innocent but now anachronistic Legend of a Mind, touting ex-Harvard psychology professor Timothy Leary as the Pied Piper of LSD. It would not be long before the Moody Blues followed the Beatles' lead by starting their own record label. John Lodge of the Moody's explains why.
Total artistic control, no financial reason. I mean, actually, the record company, our own record company, has cost us a lot of money over the years. But it set a precedent. It set up exactly what we wanted to do with our music, and that was albums. We wanted the artwork right. We wanted our own type of advertising. We wanted our own everything, you know, because we really believed in all the music, and not just the music. Everything else had to be right. We didn't want anything to look as though it was a sham or a hype. And the record company just had no idea what we were trying to do at all. You know, after the In Search of Lost Chord, we were making our albums because we knew exactly what we wanted to do. And the record company still had this, that you had to have a hit single and only singles. And I remember them turning up and wanted us to do Over the Rainbow. And they kept saying, it's got to be a big hit record for you. And it just, we were looking at them saying, you really don't know where we're at, do you? You have no idea at all. And I think that's the last meeting we ever took with A&R, with a record company, because no one seemed to know what we were trying to do.
Bluebird flying high, tell me what you say. If you could talk to me, what news would you bring? Of voices in the sky. Nightingale hovering high, harmonize the wind. Darkness, your symphony, I can hear you sing. Of voices in the sky. Just what is happening to me? I lie awake with the sound of the sea calling to me. Old man passing by, tell me what you say. Though your voice be faint, I am listening. Voices in the sky. Children with a skipping rope, tell me what you sing. Playtime is nearly gone, the bell's about to ring. Voices in the sky. Just what is happening to me? I lie awake with the sound of the sea calling to me. Tell me what you sing. If you could talk to me, what news would you bring? Of voices in the sky. Voices in the sky. Voices in the sky.
By 1970, the Moody's were quite prolific, doing two full albums a year and touring whenever they weren't in the studio. They were getting famous and generating a lot of money. For somebody, here's Justin Hayward.
Well, he may have earned it, but it wasn't. They didn't give it to me because we were all still living in apartments, you know. We had a lousy... You remember I said a while ago they owed the record company £5,000? To pay that back, we were like on a royalty of about 2% for Days of Future Past, rising to about 5% by the time it got to Question of Balance. So no matter what the songs and the records earned, you know, it was a long time before we started making any money ourselves. It was probably like 70, 71 before we really started making any money.
For all of their growing popularity, it's notable that no personality emerged as the focus of the marketing in the way John Lennon and Paul McCartney had with the Beatles, or Mick Jagger and Keith Richards with the Rolling Stones. Justin Hayward of the Moody Blues maintains that it was no accident.
It was a deliberate thing, and I think because we wanted our music to speak for us instead of any particular kind of visual image, you know, of a sort of pop band. We didn't want to use those particular kind of channels of publicity, and we didn't see ourselves like that. Like I said, we wanted the music to do our talking for us, and that was why. And with the music and the record sleeves were the things that we wanted people to associate with the band, not particularly personalities and faces, because I think also we'd seen a lot of people. This is easier for me to say with hindsight, because I have seen a lot of people, you know, come and go because they've just relied on their own personal image to get them through. And that's a choice that you make in this business. You want to employ a press agent to tell the airport authorities every time you're coming through, you know, that you're coming through. So they've got all the photographers there, and you want to go everywhere in a limo and all that kind of stuff, and go shopping in a limo. And so you make it a big deal around yourself. And it's a very hard road to walk all the time. Some people can do it. Some people make a career of arriving at an airport, you know, and being photographed to go into the White House. Some people build a career on that.
Justin Hayward of the Moody Blues.
But I think the album where it really came right was an album called Threshold of a Dream, which was after Lost Chord, and I think that was the one where we thought, yeah, we've got it, we've developed, we know what our own style is and what we're now meant to be doing. From there, I think we started to get very complicated after that, and we by the time we were doing Children's Children, we were getting into the realms of exploring so much. We'd had a lot of record success then, and the record company was bending over backwards to give us anything that we wanted. We used to demand silly things, like we'd had every instrument of the orchestra delivered to the studio, courtesy of the record company, just in case we wanted to go and tink or bump on any kind of instrument. And it wasted an incredible amount of time, you know.
Gypsy comes from the Moody Blues 1969 album To Our Children's Children's Children, a ponderous album which reflected the very young band members' somewhat precious attitudes toward sudden fame, according to Justin Hayward.
Whenever we started an album, I'd build myself a little guitar house, you know, in one corner. We'd each have our own area of the studio and make it all psychedelic and put posters up in our bit of the studio and have table lamps with scarves over them and all that, and joysticks going, and it got a bit ridiculous. But by the time Children's Children came along, we were getting into the realms of recording things that we could never do on stage. And I love Children's Children as an album, but it was, like I say, it was getting impossible to do because we'd taken the recording process so far.
Watching and waiting for a friend to play with. Why have I been alone so long?
Someone to understand.